All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Neil, it's been a minute. How's it going this week, man?
It's finals week for students. Last day of classes is tomorrow, so getting all those, procrastinators across the finish line.
The last minute begging, head bowed, samurai sword in hands for forgiveness. I know this tradition well. And are you the kind of teacher that's going to deal with these students with mercy?
I'm happy to get any student across the finish line that like reasonably can, but when you come to me 2 hours before class is closed and you've got like a 3%, like, sorry, but
that's not all you can do. That's, the mathematics just aren't going to work out on that one, are they?
Yeah.
All right, man. And hey, what have you been? You've been playing some Total War Warhammer. I saw you were playing that last night. How's that going?
Good. They came out with a another expansion patch that overhauled my favorite faction. To the point that my favorite faction is now broken.
Oh, sweet!
Hell yeah!
In a good way. Like they're way stronger.
Like, yeah, like the NPC version of that faction will like take over half of the map while you're still just dicking around. Mm. Which, on the one hand, it's nice to be overpowered in fights, but on the other hand, like it kind of, part of the appeal of that faction is that like they're under siege and like I want to be the grand unifier, and then I run into one of the NPC factions and they're like three times as big as me, and it's like, oh, you didn't really need rescuing, did you?
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of like in Dota, like 6 months ago, like Nature's Prophet got this big buff and then he had like a really high percent win. Like normally he has like a 40 some percent win rate because nobody knows how to play him, but he had like a 50 some and he just became like the most overpowered hero in the game, and I had like a 15 game win streak going on that guy for a little bit there. That was a nice 2 weeks while that lasted before Valve swung the ban hammer absolutely mercilessly. Anyway, okay, good to know you, everything's going good. And when does your summer break officially begin?
I'll be teaching summer school, so late June.
Okay. Well, mo money. All right. Speaking of mo money, Gideon, what's going on this week, man?
Nothing much. I've been watching lots of stuff. I watched Speed Racer again for the first time since probably 2008. That was awesome. I really hope that comes to 4K at some point. I rewatched V for Vendetta. I started watching the Rise of the Planet of the Apes movies, like the newer trilogy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because I haven't seen those. We finished the second one, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, yesterday. Really been liking those. I've been playing Witcher 3. I'm right at where I've usually like quit in all the like.
Which time. Is where?
It's like basically right after like finishing the Bloody Baron, or like getting a little bit past that, like with the witches of Crookback Bog or whatever. But I'm playing on Death March. I'm taking my time. I'm reading guides. I'm doing everything I can to make it as easy for me to get into it and just make my way through it. So I'm enjoying it. And
it seems like such a you game. I'm surprised you haven't gotten into it already.
Yeah, I mean, I'd started it like two or three times like over the years. I feel like I've had it since 2015. Yeah. But something just always like pulled me away from it, and I'm definitely liking it a lot, and I'm kind of glad I waited for like the PS5 upgrade and everything.
Yeah, for sure.
Beautiful.
It's so pretty.
Go ahead.
Sorry, speaking of things that Gideon would be into, Gideon, are you familiar with a animated movie called The Thief and the Cobbler?
I don't think so. That sounds... I don't think I know that.
So it's this like very storied production. Like it started in the 60s and like didn't get a release until the 90s.
Famously
like over budget, behind production schedules, and like what got released was not what the lead animator / director had in mind. Like the studios just like butchered it.
Okay.
So it has like three separate releases.
Oh wow.
Like
three different cuts of it.
Yeah, three different cuts. Okay. And then finally, like, a bunch of animator, like, people in the animation community have been working, like, off of storyboards and from the director's notes and, like, as, like, a passion project, like, slowly filling in scenes.
Dude, and, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'll send you a link of the latest with what they call the recobbled cut.
Okay.
Which is supposed to be, like, the thing closest to the director's original vision.
I'm looking at Google Images, and I feel like I've seen... I probably saw like a YouTube video talk about it at one point, because one of these images is definitely familiar. So I must have heard about it at some point.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But I was considering like doing something similar to what we can discuss with Blade Runner,
mm-hmm.
As my suggestion, where everybody watched like one of the different cuts and we discussed, but I think that would have just gotten too complicated.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I've been watching it, and I think you would like it just from the animation perspective.
Hell yeah. Thanks for the recommendation, dude. I'll put it in my watch list so I don't forget.
Well, just DM me the link, because the recobbled cut is all on YouTube, because like...
Okay.
Ownership is so weird on it right now.
And that sci-fi Dune miniseries, that was on YouTube, right? You sent me that?
Yep.
Okay. Awesome. Hell yeah, dude. Thank you. Thief and the Cobbler.
All right.
Nice.
Well, it's like we're off to the races with a good start here. So we're here to talk about the 1973 George Lucas movie pre-Star Wars, crazy. American Graffiti. This was one of the... This is a movie that was recommended to me by my parents initially, who had both liked it. And of course, like, I was a big Star Wars fan as a kid, just like I feel like everybody was. And they were like, oh, did you know he made this movie before Star Wars? And it has a bunch of people who would end up kind of like either connected to Star Wars or connected to other Lucas projects in some way in it. And I was, you know, obviously I didn't know anything about it. And so we watched down and it was my favorite movie for years. We sat down and watched it. I remember on our old tube TV in my basement, maybe on... No, it couldn't have been on VHS. It was probably like early DVD, and just totally loved it. So I wanted to bring it to the podcast, because this is a movie I have a lot of nostalgia for. I wasn't sure if you guys had seen it before. Neil, I think your history with it was you had heard of this, but you'd never seen it before?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was totally blind.
Okay, awesome. And how about you, Gideon?
I had seen it, and I saw a friend of mine showed it to me in like our last days of high school.
Oh, cool.
It was like perfect time to watch it. So I had like nostalgic memories from watching it that one time. And this was the first time I'd revisited since that.
Okay, sweet. So a little plot summary on the movie. The funny thing is here, it's very easy to describe this movie, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily very plot heavy. It's very just kind of a hangout movie. And really what it is it's set in 1962 and in like Southern California, and the cruising and car cultures and classic rock and roll and all that. It follows the lives of four people as like on their last night of high school, basically. So we've got Ron Howard's character, Richard Dreyfuss's character. Paul Lamatt, who plays Milner. Milner, and we follow Toad around for a little bit, who's like the school geek. So we kind of follow like their four stories on their last night in town before like the next morning. Some of them may or may not be going off to college, and it's just about one last final night, and they all kind of have their separate adventures, Interestingly enough, they all kind of have their own complete character arc within that final night. And just, you know, fun events transpire. It's really not that complicated of a movie. So, Neil, what were your initial... I'm curious, like, what were your initial thoughts having never seen this before?
Okay, so the very first thought that I had from watching this movie was about Richard Dreyfuss. And before anybody says a word in the movie, I was like, man, why are all these high school kids hanging out with a 30-year-old man?
Literally.
Because, I think he was 28 when they like during filming.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like 2 years later, he's going to be in Jaws as like a grizzled college.
Like a PhD candidate or.
Yeah, PhD candidate. He's like another 2 years later, he's in Close Encounters of the Third Kind as a family man. Like, it was an odd casting choice, but I get the impression that he has connections to Spielberg and Lucas and like was like a favorite or friend of theirs or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing to point out is there are a few, I mean, there's the cast of this movie has not a lot of huge names aside from Richard Dreyfuss and Ron Howard. Something interesting to note is Ron Howard's girlfriend in this movie was the first pick for Princess Leia in Star Wars, and it went to Carrie Fisher instead.
Oh, wow.
And of course, the other Star Wars connection is that Harrison Ford is in this movie for like 5 to 10 minutes. He's not in it a lot, but he makes an impression. And it's clear from his presence in this movie, you're like, that guy's going to be a movie star. Absolutely. Sort of reminds me of Brad Pitt's role in Thelma and Louise in that same way, where it's like evident from the minute he shows up, you're like, this guy's going to be up to big things in the future. So yeah, what were your kind of initial thoughts on the quality of the movie? Did you like it? Tell me about all that, Neil.
I did have a little bit of trouble. I felt like the first 30 minutes were kind of rough. But eventually it did hook me in. It's definitely like a nostalgic movie in a lot. I mean, it's preying on nostalgia, like blatantly so, I think. Where, you know, just based on the time frame, it's harkening back to like 10 years in the past at the time of release. I think it came out in 73 and is set in 62. And like you said, it's all about neon lights, car culture in what's like supposed to be like small town California. And one of my thoughts was like, man, like George Lucas, I assume, like grew up in this like
kind of
place. And one of the themes is like, you know, getting out of your dinky hometown and like going off and quote unquote making something of yourself. And I'm just like, wait, this is George Lucas's definition of a small town. There's places to go.
Yeah.
You need a car to get around town. You can't just bike. Like, okay.
There's a lot going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Like if this is your definition of podunk, I don't want you to like, look into my past.
Yeah. This reminds me of a dichotomy you have. So obviously I'm living in Minneapolis now, but I'm not from Minneapolis. And when you talk to people that are from here, like from actual Minneapolis proper, and they say the city, they really just mean the borders of Minneapolis. Like, you'll go to like a tier one suburb like St. Louis Park. And Neil, you know where that is, obviously.
Yeah,
they don't even, people from Minneapolis don't even consider St. Louis Park the city, even though like it's right there. And it's funny, like when I was living in St. Cloud and I was driving in to like do band practice on the weekends, if once I was in like the 30 minute radius, like outside of the cities, I was considering myself in the city. So I think people that are from big cities have like a totally distorted view of reality in my sense. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, like that's not like a knock against the movie itself. It's just more like, you know, it's kind of like Hollywood elitism on a certain.
Yeah, it's just like George Lucas being weird.
Yeah,
but like, at the same time, like, you know, that's just that's his experience, and I think they're probably. I think on a certain level it might be a little autobiographical. Like,
yeah.
I think there's elements of like his life within mm-hmm. the and it's interesting just from that perspective. But like you know, it's interesting to see the town take shape as the nightlife progresses. Mm-hmm. There's like a, not like a motorcycle gang, but like a greaser gang, the Pharaohs, and
yeah,
they run into them. And there's just like a lot of, like teenage angst in this movie. It just reeks of angst, where like, you know, everybody wants to hook up with, like, all the girls are still interested in Ron Howard, even though he's been going out with Richard Dreyfuss's sister forever, because it's gonna be his last night in town, and he's a big shot in the context of the movie. Ron Howard proposes that he and Richard Dreyfuss' sister should be in an open relationship.
Yeah.
Because he's going to college and she's staying in town. Like, just that might have been the moment that like reeled me. I was like, oh man, like this is just a terrible decision. Like, I know that's a terrible decision. Why are you bringing this up?
Right.
Clearly, you know, like, it can only get worse from here.
But it's very real. Like, I think one might go into this movie thinking it's going to be like a really positive nostalgia bomb. And in a lot of ways it is, but I like that it doesn't shy away from being like, no, these are still real people with all the same tendencies and negative aspects of you know, human behavior that we deal with in the modern day. Like every guy in a relationship at the end of high school that was like going off and his girlfriend was like staying in their hometown has had that exact same dilemma, right? That's very real. Not everything goes great all the time in this movie. People get beat up, a liquor store gets robbed. I mean, it's not like the hunky-dory world of like the good parts of Blue Velvet, you know what I mean? It's not like this overly nostalgic thing. He's not afraid to be like, no, sometimes things really sucked. Speaking of which, by the end of this movie, one of the things that, first of all, the soundtrack is really great in this movie, but what is it with every song from this era being like, you're 16, you're underage.
Oh my God. For real.
Okay, like, that was one scene that was just like, I didn't understand, was at one, I think this is like a generational shift.
Mm-hmm.
And also like an availability of things to do in like my hometown versus, again, this quote unquote small town. But at one point they go back to the high school where there's like a dance being held over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Dreyfuss
teachers hitting on all the young girls at the dance.
Yeah. And it's just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. That was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I mean, though. Like, that, even though in the modern parlance, you know, it's obviously not acceptable. When my mom graduated Muscatine High School in 1982, Gideon, you know Flad, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He married somebody in my mom's class.
That is wild.
So she would have been, you know, either 17 or 18 at that time. And that was his first year teaching.
That is wild.
Yeah. So, I mean, that shit just used to be more socially, and I'm not putting a modern judgment one way or the other on. I'm just saying shit like that used to be way more socially acceptable. And I love that George Lucas doesn't like stray away from that too much in this movie. Before you go too much further on it, Gideon, I want to get your like initial quality assessment, even though you've kind of seen this before.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd only seen it the one time. Didn't remember too much. I do agree. I like how it doesn't shy away, like warts and all, kind of showing, you know, the guy's got the dilemma with his girlfriend. He's going to be 3,000 miles away. Maybe he doesn't handle it the best. And different things like that, I thought was pretty well done. I liked this quite a bit on a rewatch. I think it's a really, like Neil said, you know, definitely preying on nostalgia, but it does really well with the nostalgia takes on it. And I love a good period piece where it feels like you're kind of like living in that era. And I wish, you know, I could go back in time and check out different eras of Americana and stuff like that. And this movie gives you a little bit of a taste of that, and I really appreciate it for that. And even with some of the maybe unsavory bits, you know, I'm not really one for remaking movies, but I think it would be hilarious if they remade this movie as a horror movie for all the, like, you know, hey, strange, hey, I'm a stranger. Why don't you women get in my car? And,
yeah,
oh, your minor sister's going to ride along in my car, or whatever, you know. So I thought that was just funny, just from the how things have kind of changed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah. So something I want to talk about, something that I really felt strongly on this rewatch that I had never really realized before. There's a really great scene in the first season of Mad Men where Don is giving this speech about nostalgia and how it means pain from an old wound. Like, that's where the origin of the, like, that's the etymology of the word nostalgia. And that is the key word that really comes to mind for me about this movie, is that it is nostalgic and it is kind of happy, but there's this real twinge of pain, because you know that in the next year or two, things are going to go horrible. And this is before, by the way, the epilogue of this movie is fucking awful. Like, that should never have been in this movie, and that was added at all blows my mind. But pretend like the epilogue didn't happen and we don't know what happens to these people down the line. You know, just colloquially, this is 62. We're a year and some change out from the Kennedy assassination. We're a year and some change out from, like, getting more heavily involved in the Vietnam War. Right, like the 60s and what was classic Americana is going to turn into just a total nightmare in the next few years for all the men that are in that are coming of age in this movie. Like, when Milner shuts off the radio and he's like, eh, I don't really like the Beach Boys, rock and roll has been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died. It's like he doesn't even know that the Beatles are coming in like a year and are going to change the entire culture. You know what I mean? Like, just there's this painful aspect of it for me, which is like, I feel almost sympathetic for these characters because they don't know that, like, the entire culture is going to just come crashing down around them. And this really is not only the last hurrah for these four specifically, but the last hurrah for this entire carefree post-war generation before things turn into the 60s and just go to complete shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt a real kind of like pain about that, and
yeah.
I don't know, it just hit me in a really kind of special emotional way, like it had never really hit me before. I don't know if you guys have any feelings about that.
It's like shockingly melancholy,
and yeah,
especially with the end. Just to touch on that, I'm like, is this the movie that starts the trend where George Lucas kills off his cool characters? When it's like, oh, John Milner died from a fucking drunk driver a year later, or like that Christmas. I'm like, fuck you, George Lucas.
Yeah.
I'm like, he was so cool. And even like the way he handled dealing with the minor that he didn't really want in his car.
Yeah.
And it's like, it could have got really creepy and weird, but he was, I thought that was done pretty well.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Gideon.
Oh, no, you're fine. Last thing I was going to say, but yeah, I agree. Like, just like the whole weight of the world about to come crashing down on them, and feeling that like they're like literally in the last days of like their youth and like almost like their true innocence before all this crazy shit in the world happens. So I definitely agree with you.
Yeah. Neil, what were you going to say, bud?
So going back to the bit with the young girl in John Milner's car for most of the movie, which I thought was actually one of the more interesting dynamics. So like in the context of the movie, John Milner is like, so Ron Howard and Richard Dreyfuss's characters have just graduated high school. John Milner is like their friend who was like a senior when they were freshmen. Like he's older than the rest of them by some degree. So that makes like the age gap with this like eighth grade girl even bigger. But When I saw the actress, my first thought was that she was the younger version of Marion Ravenwood, like from the first Indiana Jones movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to look her up, and it's not her. But throughout the movie, like, she's like constantly sort of like joking, teasing John Milner's character, like, you know, if you don't keep me around here, I'm gonna tell everybody that you raped me, and you know, she's like being a brat to get her way. And I looked up the actress, and like literally at the time of filming, so she's the daughter of the lead singer of the Mamas and the Papas, and famously was like the victim of an incestual rape situation with him.
Holy shit, dude.
Wow, I didn't know any of that.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and then that led me like deeper into like the rabbit hole of like other things about this movie. And so the next thing you find out is that like 3 years later they made a sequel called More American Graffiti, which I think covers the deaths of two of the characters from the movie, which I was like, but like when I saw that they made a sequel, I was like, this movie didn't need a sequel.
No, not
that it's bad. I'm not saying like it didn't deserve a sequel, but like I think particularly with that ending, they give you the information like people died just as like a text over, like just before the credits roll.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I was like, okay, we don't need a sequel to this movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just feel like that end text is totally unnecessary, because I thought the another like emotional through line of the movie that I really heavily relate to, and I was glad to see it resolved. Well, not even resolved, but I was glad to see it addressed in the last few seconds of the movie, was Richard Dreyfuss getting on the plane, and even as he's flying away on the plane, you can see the white Thunderbird with the blonde inside of it from the plane, and he like looks down and he just kind of smiles, like he's made the right decision to just leave anyway. And then of course right after that the text pops up and it's like John Mildred died in a car crash and Toad got killed in Vietnam. Like, it's just a very weird note to end.
Even that too, another gripe I had with that is like, you just talk about the men and you don't talk about the women. And I feel like some of the women are more interesting than the men characters. Like
who?
I wanted to know more about Lori than I wanted to know about Steve or Ron Howard's character. I wanted to know more about the girl that Toad was with than Toad. I didn't give a shit about what Toad is doing.
Toad is like, has some of the funniest shit in the movie, but I agree that he's like not a really interesting. I think John Milner is the most interesting character in this movie.
He's definitely my favorite.
I will also say he has the absolute sickest car in this movie, the yellow
with the hood off and everything.
Yeah, it's like a 37.
I don't know what car that
Uber
is.
Something like that. And
Easter egg, his license plate is a reference to George Lucas' previous movie, THX. I think the movie's 1130.
So I'm gonna blow your guys' mind on another Easter egg related to John Milner's car. In Attack of the Clones, you know the initial scene where they're in Coruscant and Anakin jumps into like a yellow speeder that's like flying through the city? That speeder is based on John Milner's car in American Graffiti.
Shit, dude, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
so cool. Yeah, so they brought it back for that, which is pretty cool.
I wanted to throw in a little bit of trivia. I was reading the trivia on the IMDb page earlier for this episode about Carol, the miner that's hanging out with John Milner. Apparently, so she was like, I think 12 at the time when she got the role, and her parents just like booked her a flight, sent her there. With like no, like they didn't have any plans or nothing set in place for like her living situation and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So the producer on this movie became their legal guardian and like took care of her. I'm like, Jesus Christ! Like, talk about the times being different. Like something like that.
Francis Ford Coppola, you mean?
I would think so. It just said the producer. I know.
Yeah, because he is the producer,
like the main one. So I don't know if it was. It didn't name him. I don't know if there was additional producers, but
that's pretty bonkers.
It was crazy.
So what else do we want to mention on this movie. I agree that Ron Howard's character is a little flat, but I think he's mainly there to be a contrast against Richard Dreyfuss, who's a much, not only a much better actor, in my opinion, but just a better written character. And I like him chasing after the girl in the White Thunderbird. And I like his a lot of his stuff with the Pharaohs is really funny. Mm-hmm. Like when he sneaks up behind the car and he ties the back axle up, and then they speed off, and the rear tires both fall off the car. I thought that was pretty sweet.
I like his indecisiveness about not knowing to stay or go. I feel like that's pretty relatable, especially at that point in your life, like end of high school, trying to figure out this next big step.
Well, didn't you guys think it was kind of funny? Like, my reaction to that was like, what do you mean you don't know you're going to go? Like, it must have been such a small financial decision if you didn't know you were going to go to college or not. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
if it was nowadays, it would be like, no, you knew this 3 years ago and you're fucking locked in. There's no getting out of this. Like, you're going.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
I think part of it is also just like the difference in like standards of the time, where like at the end, Richard Dreyfuss's character decides, yes, he is going to go to the East Coast to go to college. And there's like a one strip airport in town, and his family can like stand by the boarding ramp as they wave him goodbye, like separated by like a waist high chain link fence.
Yeah. Like,
and he gets on and he's got like his jacket over his arm, like three books and a radio. And he's just going to go to like Maine or something.
Right.
Mm-hmm. God,
even that, like, I was joking with Alyssa watching this. I was like, is Jaws the sequel to this movie? Because he's going east, and then he's like a college guy studying sharks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was also like, is Deckard a replicant in this movie? You know? Because it kind of felt like it sometimes, just the way he was acting.
He just starts singing Some Enchanted Evening in the middle of the car when Laurie's in the car with him. It's like, what the hell is happening right now?
And switching gears a little bit, but one thing, kind of talking about like the pain of nostalgia and things not being how they were, it was like, goddamn, these cool fucking cars that they have. So cool. Like, I'm like, number one, like, I don't know enough about the car world and everything, but like, is there actual like legitimate good reasons why we don't have cars that cool anymore? Like, those cars are like, they look like spaceships.
Yeah.
And then when he's messing with the cops, it's like $799 for a car. I'm like, $800 mm-hmm. bucks for a car that is like presumably new. And I think a TV, it was like $160 or something, or $185. I was like, this is just, it was just cool seeing that.
Yeah. It's the post-war American economy where you just like back, you can be like a factory worker basically and support a family of four on one income, like working basically like somebody who would work at Han for Muscatine standards. I mean, yeah, those days are long gone, unfortunately. Yeah, I don't know about the whole car thing. I think it just industrial design has changed. I would also say that there ended up being kind of, I think as the economy tanked in the late 60s and then into the 70s, there ended up being more of a race to the bottom to see who could, like, it wasn't about like, oh, let's get all this chrome and all these fins and all these beautiful colors and the lights on the cars. It was like, let's make everything monkey shit brown and into the biggest, boxiest, ugliest piece of shit you've ever seen. It reminds me of the car advertisement from RoboCop where he's like, I want a car with really shitty gas mileage. I mean, this is like every car from the 70s.
Yeah.
Other bits of this movie, I really like the bit where Toad is trying to get liquor from the liquor store.
Yeah.
And he's talking to the crazy old guy and he's like, I don't have my ID because I lost it in a flood. And the old guy's like, I lost my wife too. Her name was ID, but it wasn't in no flood or something like that. That was just really funny to me. And when he finally gets the guy to agree to get him the liquor, the guy ends up like robbing the store and then throwing him the booze. And that actor barely catches
yeah.
catches the booze. I don't know. Toad has a lot of great lines, like where the other guy says to him when he's flirting with Debbie, I think her name is, and he's like, "You want a knuckle sandwich?" And Toad's like, no, I got a double cheeseburger coming." Like,
yeah,
that was... I thought that part was funny. Thoughts on Toad?
He is fun. I also learned in the trivia at the beginning of the movie when he crashes his Vespa, that was just like totally unscripted. He actually just lost control and crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it was so like in character for that.
Yeah.
Character, you know. So that was a nice little moment. And it was just funny, you know, seeing how he was acting and all this like bravado. It's like not even his car. It's like, dude, the amount of anxiety I would have, like, not my vehicle. You're fucking trying to race people. You're crashing into somebody in reverse and speeding off. Like,
that's like my favorite scene.
Yeah.
Like, go ahead, Neil.
Like, what was Ron Howard thinking? Like, I didn't have a car in high school, but if I'd had a car in high school, there's no way I'm like telling some junior when I'm graduating, like, "Oh yeah, you can hold on to my car for me while I'm gone." No.
No way in hell. No way. And if anybody, it's like, wouldn't you give it to like John, because he like works on cars and shit, you know, like he would actually probably take proper care of it, and like I think he like worked in that garage or something. Yeah.
I love when he tries to take off at the start. There it's like him and another car at a red light, and they're both stopped, and he takes off, he's like revving his engine like he's gonna race the guy. The light doesn't turn green. The go left arrow turns green, and he jumps the gun too early, and he shoots out there. He backs it up, and then when he tries to go, when it actually goes green, he floors it in reverse and it destroys the car behind him. And the guy gets out, and he's like, "Oh, excuse me, I think we've had an accident." So it's like, "Well, I'll let it pass this time, but next time, watch out, goddammit!" Like,
I
really think that scene is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Neil, thoughts on Toad?
Like, I think he's an interesting character because I think everybody has a Toad in their life. You know, that guy that like they treated their Toad way better than I treated my Toad.
Yeah, they are kind of nice. They are kind of nice to Toad, and you're right, in kind of a nice, in kind of a nice way. You know, I was just thinking about this. This just kind of occurred to me. Do you guys think that, like, I almost said Han Solo, Harrison Ford coming into town, like, represents, like, there's always going to be a bigger fish. Like, the future is coming, and all these people are not going to, like, be the best forever. Like, Milner is not going to be the best forever, and all these people are getting older and things like that. I mean, like, Harrison Ford's character is, like, the manifestation of like impending doom on like these characters, like not being in their prime anymore.
Even when John is talking to Carol in the junkyard, he's talking about like drunk driving accidents or something, right? Mm-hmm. It's like foreshadowing almost that end title card. Yeah.
And Milner's always talking about shit like that. He has so many like little monologues in the movie that are like, "Oh, rock and roll's gone downhill. The strip used to be three times longer than it is now. The pickings are really getting slim around here. There's no good chicks anymore." Like,
I mean, you know, Milner's like also, I think, an archetypal character that everybody had, the guy who peaked in high school and never left town and like never had a chance to leave town, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, most of them. I know a lot of them. Muscatine. They sell. They work at like Toyota or whatever, or they like sell insurance or something like that. It is. Yeah, go ahead, Gideon.
I just want to shout out Wolfman Jack. Very interesting character. I love a good disc jockey. I love that it was actually Wolfman Jack. Apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Gives huge Three Dogs energy. I wonder if this guy inspired Three Dogs.
Yeah, probably.
I would think so. They seem pretty similar. And I love how he's just like, he kept being like, "Please help me finish these goddamn popsicles." And he's like, doesn't take him up on it. He's like, "The fridge is broke." That was great.
Yeah, he was great, and I like that reoccurring thing of like they didn't know. That's another thing I think we don't really appreciate about our modern age, or rather that's kind of lost on us, is you could have mysteries like this where it was like, who the hell is Wolfman Jack and where is he broadcasting from? And the pharaohs think he's broadcasting from Mexico, and Laurie says he's like flying around in a blimp and broadcasting from the sky, and they're like, the FBI is after him, and it's like he's just this like lone disc jockey out right outside town. Like Richard Dreyfuss just drives up and walks into the building. He's not this, they make him out to be like Santa Claus, but they just didn't know. There was no way of like getting that information. They just, but he was still this like legendary cult figure to like all the kids in this town, basically.
It was like pirate radio. Yeah.
Yeah. Or at least they make it out to be like pirate radio. Right. But then he's just like this guy outside of town. That's, you know, 10, 15 years older than everybody else. Kind of in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Music plays a huge part in this movie. I mean, we see a live rock band. I love the soundtrack in this movie. It, like, obviously, not only is it nostalgic, it's just like, I love how the use of music, like, it's just blasting out of people's cars, right? Mm-hmm. Like, either there are scenes where cars are driving by and they're all playing the same radio station, and like, that's where a lot of the music is coming from. It's not just like an overdub. I don't know. It just, it captures the time. Not that I was there, but it captures the time excessively well. What do we think about negatives on this movie? Like, aside from the shitty epilogue, which I think we are all in agreement is very weird and out of place.
Negatives. I don't know. I don't have too much to complain with this one. I do like it quite a bit.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of find a spot to fit your finger in here and say that there's something you don't like, this or that. I mean, there's some characters that aren't as interesting as others. Like, I Ron Howard's character is kind of lame, but again, he makes a nice contrast to Richard Dreyfuss, and how like Ron Howard is talking the whole movie about how he's going to go, and then the last scene of the movie, he changes his mind. He's going to stay with Laurie. It's very romantic and admirable. And Richard Dreyfuss obviously changes his mind and ends up going. And I think John Milner even has kind of a character arc where like he's the hotshot, and by the end of the movie, like he knows that like his time has come, and he's not like, he lucked out in that last race because Harrison Ford ends up crashing his car, which was like brutal. Like when you watch that scene, you're like, Jesus Christ, somebody's gonna get killed here, and then they're both fine because it's
fine. Yeah.
How about you, Neil? Anything negative, you think?
Yeah, I think that like first 30 minutes is a little slow and takes like, I get that it's like laying a lot of foundational stuff and that's important, but I wasn't immediately pulled in, and like I kind of had to force myself. I'm glad that I forced myself to get through the first 30 minutes, but
I think that's totally fair.
I'm under other circumstances, I might have quit.
So what you don't like about the first 30 minutes is you just think it's slow?
I just think it's slow. I wasn't really invested in the characters yet. On some level, I think John Milner's character is the most interesting. And like Richard Dreyfuss's character is also like not interesting by himself. He's interesting in terms of like what happens to him.
But and like whose cars he gets into.
Yeah. That's actually a good way of thinking about it, Gideon. But yeah, like at no point did I like, was I like rooting for Richard Dreyfuss to like find the blonde and the T-Bird or something. It was like I didn't like him. It was more, I think on a certain level he's supposed to be like almost a blank everyman character, so that you can insert him into situations, but he's not a strong character in his own right.
I think the struggle that he's going through is more relatable than any of his like real character traits. you know, like his whole, he's cruising the strip on his last night and he sees the blonde and the white Thunderbird. To me, like, you know, as long as you don't take that super literally, I think that's like a very relatable experience. Like that every time you pick something in life to pursue, it's the death of a thousand different opportunities that you didn't pursue, right? And Richard Dreyfuss's character really personifies that. I mean, I don't think that's a particularly revelatory to any of us, but it definitely like hit an emotional thing for me. Just like, obviously my life has been undergoing like a lot of changes in the last month, 2 months. So I don't know. It's just, anytime your life is about to hit a big patch of changes, it feels like American Graffiti is like right there to be kind of a comforting experience, whether that's, you know, getting out of high school or, you know, other life milestones for sure. So we're coming up on an hour here. What do we feel like we want to give in terms of stars on this?
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. There's part of me that wants to give it a 5, but there's like part of me that thinks like I'm probably blinded by like movies that are about nostalgia and this particular time period, and I keep picking movies and then giving them a 5, and I feel like I'm gonna get called out on it at the end of the year, like I'm trying to pump my numbers up or something like that. So you know what, I'll give it a 4. And I'll say, like, you know, there's always room for improvement, and there's not that much wrong with this movie except for the epilogue, but you know, a 5, like Neil says, a 5's got to be like 7 Samurai. You know, it's gotta blow me away. And American Graffiti is one of the rare movies that really makes me feel something like real, and I really respect that about it. I would also say, I think before we go, we can have a discussion about like this. It's a shame that Star Wars was as big of a success as it was, because I would have taken 10 more movies like this over what George Lucas's career ended up becoming. And it is a tragedy that he didn't become more like his peers, because he went to film school in UCLA at the same time that Spielberg and Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola did. And then he didn't really have as prolific of a career after that because of Star Wars. So I would have loved to have seen more movies like this from George Lucas that were more introspective. It's almost impossible to believe that this is the same guy who ended up making like The Phantom Menace or like other later Star Wars. You know what I mean? It's just, it's crazy that somebody that is like this sensitive to human emotion, to like real characters with very real problems and real emotions, ended up making like, I hate sand, it's so coarse and it gets everywhere, you know, it's just weird.
It is strange.
So I'll give it a 4, and I really love this movie dearly, and I think it's severely underrated and overlooked, and I'll just say that it's a painful movie in many ways, including the way we just talked about, but a good kind of painful, in that at least, you know, it kind of makes you feel something. So I'll give it a 4.
Do you want to go next, Neil, or do you want
to go? Sure. I'm going to give it a very strong 3. I think we've kind of talked about this before, like the difference between a strong 3 and a 4, or a strong 4 and a 5 is like your connection to the movie. And I like, when I was watching this, kind of like you were saying, Sam, like I was like, oh, Sam's gonna fucking love this movie if he hasn't seen it before, because it expresses a lot of thoughts and emotions that like I've heard from your mouth. Which like I understand and I can see them, but I just don't feel as strongly as you. And so like I think by definition, if you're giving it a 4, I have to give it a 3. It's a good movie. It's worth watching. It's worth watching twice. It just doesn't connect to me on the same level of depth that I think you have for it.
Yeah, I totally I totally buy that.
Totally get that.
Have you get in?
I would also agree with you, Sam. I'd give it a strong 4. I think it's a really well-crafted movie. I think what you were talking about with how he became so huge with Star Wars, it almost adds to like the tragic kind of melancholy nature of this movie, and that we'd never get another movie like this from him. And for it being, what, 51 years old now, it holds up extremely well, I think. I think it's pretty high up there in the echelon of like hangout movies, especially period piece hangout movies like Dazed and Confused and stuff like that. Or even like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And yeah, I had a really good time revisiting it. I think, you know, every character seems authentic in the way that they could have been a real person, or they reflect a real person that you knew. I love a good period piece. I love seeing all the cars, all the music and everything. And getting to kind of look into a portal of a time I never lived in and stuff like that. So I really just appreciate this movie in a lot of different aspects. I was happy to revisit it. Yeah, I don't think I have too much else to add.
Awesome. Well, guys, it's been an excellent, excellent episode. I'm excited. For the two listeners out there, we all saw the Phantom Menace re-release in theaters. So in sometime in the next week or two, we'll do a bonus episode regarding the Phantom Menace. Whose turn is it to pick the actual movie? Do we know?
I think it's mine.
You think it's mine? Okay. Okay. Well, Neil, if you've got a pick, I'd love to hear it. If you don't have a pick yet, we can always talk about it in the disc.
Yeah, no. For our next assignment, I would like you guys to watch. Oh God, now I'm forgetting the name. Event Horizon.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Is this that movie with? Oh, never mind. No, it isn't.
Lawrence Fishburne, Sam Neill.
Sci-fi horror movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay, hell yeah, nice.
Okay, awesome. I'm in for an hour and 36 minutes. That is just,
there you go.
That's good shit right there. Okay. All right. Well, I'll see you guys next week. I'm gonna go eat a root beer float.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Peace out, guys.
Have a good one.
Later.